Of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dunn, coming to you live from Rochester, New York, via the Paranormal Radio Network, and also on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. For more information on the show and on my guests, visit our website at www.keyholepublishing.com. Thanks, everyone, for joining me this evening. And as always, I want to hear from you. If you're listening live tonight, join us on the message board to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. Go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com to join us in the virtual auditorium. And you can participate in the conversation there through instant messaging. You can also email me anytime with your questions and comments. The address is kdolan@rochester.rr.com. You can also call into the show toll-free at 1-877-786-0562. And if you missed any of that, it's all on the webpage at www.keyholepublishing.com. This evening, I am going to be interviewing two guests, one each hour. Both will be presenting at the Pennsylvania MUFONS conference next weekend. I know last week, if any of you were here with me last week, you heard some interviews with speakers from the Pennsylvania MUFONS conference, which is going on right now in Philadelphia. Well, the Pennsylvania MUFON group is really busy this month because they're doing another conference in Pittsburgh next week. And two of the presenters from that conference have agreed to come and talk with me this evening. One is Stan Gordon, who I understand is going to be talking about Bigfoot at the conference. Stan, thank you so much for joining me on Through the Keyhole, and I am just dying to hear about your research and what you are going to be presenting next week.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on. I have been involved in this research for quite a long time. In fact, this month will be 50 years. That I've been researching, investigating UFOs and Bigfoot and other phenomena here in Pennsylvania.
And, wow, that's really something for people who are skeptical and they say, oh, there's nothing to it.
You know, well, I can tell you, there's definitely something to it.
Yeah, it's 50 years worth.
That's right. I started when I was 10 years old, and coincidentally, how I got involved, my birthday is Halloween Eve, October 30th.
Oh, and
On my 10th birthday, my parents gave me a new AM radio, and I was tuning around the AM radio dial that night because of Halloween season. They were talking about strange, unusual happenings, ghosts and flying saucers and all kind of mysteries. And I was very curious when I was young, and I listened intently and wanted to know if these people really seeing what they're seeing. So I began to go to the local library and read all the books they had on the subject and began to clip articles out of the newspapers and continued from there. And then when I was 16 years old, the incident that I'm probably best known for has been my pretty much lifetime investigation of the Kecksburg UFO crash that happened in Kecksburg, PA, about 12 miles from where I live in the western Pennsylvania. That's about 40 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. And I've been pursuing that case ever since and still working on that case, in fact. But what I did when I was 16, as I said, I was 16 when I got involved with the Kecksburg incident. And And after that case, I went out in the field and began to conduct first-hand interviews with people who had seen anything unusual in the area. In 1969, I set up a hotline for the public, which is still active today, where people could report UFO sightings or anything that was strange and unusual. But I can tell you, I began at that early age to begin to make contact with the local police and the newspapers and told them what I was doing. And I'm sure, as you know, there was quite a bit of ridicule back then, but they began to take me pretty serious, and I tried to show them what I was doing. Well, it wasn't long that when the public knew about my hotline, that it was just I was being inundated with phone calls day and night. And it got to the point where I realized this was much more than I could handle on my own, and that to properly investigate these cases, I needed research people, scientists, engineers, technicians, all kind of specialists to get involved. So that was my goal, to set up a volunteer group of research people who could respond to these cases very quickly. And that's exactly what I did. In 1970, I founded the three volunteer groups. That was the Westmoreland County UFO Study Group. And with my electronics background, I set up a two-way radio system so we could dispatch investigators out to the scene of these incidents in some areas. And we built and we purchased what we could. I mean, this is a lot of our own time and pocket, but we had a lot of very good technical people, so we built a lot of research equipment, which wasn't easily available back in those days. And we were pretty well equipped and got to be pretty well trained. And in hundreds and hundreds of cases, we had investigators or teams on scene of an incident within minutes to hours after it happened. And I can tell you that we worked on thousands of cases over the years of everything strange, UFO sightings, Bigfoot, all kinds of strange events. And many times we got there very soon after it happened and found some very good physical evidence of some of the cases. But I can tell you, after all these years, I still have never seen a UFO or Bigfoot myself.
Really? After all that time, you still haven't seen one?
No. Wow. I've seen a lot of evidence, but I haven't seen anything that I could say was surely unidentifiable.
Wow, that's really interesting. I mean, I know a lot of researchers who have gotten caught up in the field because they've heard about it or they've spoken to people or they've read the books, and they got caught up in investigating, and they say they have not seen anything. But I didn't ever know anyone who's been in the field this long and still hasn't seen one.
No, like I said, especially with some of the Bigfoot cases, it was just amazing, some of the events, especially during the 1970s, which Richard, in fact, I'm going to have to get a copy of Richard's new book, but I know he hits a lot of the reports of the early 1970s when I was very, very active with my research groups, and it was just amazing what was going on. In fact, my program will be an updated program on this massive wave of UFO sightings and Bigfoot events that happened 1973, the summer of 1973 into 1974 in western Pennsylvania. And it was an intriguing time to live through, I can tell you, because back then, when all this was going on, I have a pretty large communication center in my home. Our command center, if you want to call it, was set up in my house. And it got to the point where we had two phone lines in the house. Phones were just being inundated with calls day and night. In fact, in more than one case, the phone lines went out of order because they couldn't handle all the calls coming in during this wave of reports.
Wow.
We had people at the radio dispatch center working here 24 hours a day. We all did this again around our jobs. We had teams out 24 hours a day going to these scenes. Back then, we had a lot of input from the police department, the news media, so a lot of the reports coming in during this event was being referred to us by the police departments. And in a number of cases, they themselves investigated these reports as well. And it was just an amazing time to live through, I can tell you.
It sounds like it was. My gosh. And, you know, you keep talking about being back in that time and having two phone lines, for example. And all it made me think was how many families have how many phone lines these days? I mean, everybody's got cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have a home line. A lot of people have a home office phone line. And, you know, you have to kind of remember. I have to tell my kids. They'll say things about, well, you know, didn't you have a cell phone when you were 10, Mom? No, nobody had them.
Right.
You know, when I was 10, there weren't all of these phones. And so I'm listening to you talk about this, and I'm thinking, wow, a lot of people didn't have this technology. And nowadays, with ghost hunters on TV and UFO hunters, and everybody's walking around with their little electromagnetic field recorders and
right.
detectors, and you can order anything off the Internet. Well, we didn't have the Internet back then either.
No, and I wish I did.
I mean, it's been an amazing resource, but it's just fascinating to listen to you talk about how you were setting up this whole research organization and thinking that you didn't have a lot of the resources that we just take for granted today.
That's correct. Back then, you know, I would spend, it would be incredible the amount of money was involved just for paying for every stamp and every envelope and every report form you have to send out to people, which today is a lot easier when you have email, of course.
Email, right. And you can send hundreds of emails all at once if you want to send
right.
out questionnaires
right.
or let people know about a conference.
Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, would you like me to tell you about some of the things that we got involved with back in the 70s?
Absolutely. I would love to hear it.
Okay. Well, as you know, and of course I'm sure Richard's book really gets into this, that in the fall of 1973, the United States experienced a massive wave of UFO sightings across the country. It was making a lot of news on national and local news, newspapers covering a lot of stories in the fall of 73. But here in Pennsylvania, it began actually the first day, January 1st of 1973, continued all year long. We investigated hundreds and hundreds of UFO cases. And, of course, one thing I learned a long time ago when I was out in the field back in the early days, and still goes today, when you investigate UFO sightings or any other phenomena, many things appear to be strange and unusual on the surface, but when you properly investigate, many are determined to be either natural or man-made in origin. But there's that percentage of sightings you cannot easily dismiss. And I can tell you there was a lot of very high-quality UFO-type events that happened in Pennsylvania during that wave of 1973. And I'm sure Richard has some of these mentioned in his book, but we had, you know, things hovering over cars, following cars, landing on roadways. There were landings where alleged occupants were being reported. It was just an amazing time. But the UFO sightings in themselves was very intriguing. But what was really amazing, what was about to happen in the summer of 1973. And how this all began, I received a call, let me think here a second, August the 7th, 1973, from a relative of a person who lived in a rural area only a few miles from my house, outside of Greensburg, PA. And this gentleman, it was a warm summer, he had his bathroom window open, he was shaving early that night because he gets up early in the morning to go to work, and he began to sneeze, he smelled this funny odor, he said it was something like rotten cucumber. And he turned around and happened to look at the window, the bathroom window, and here's these two huge glowing red eyes staring at him through the window. But the window's 8 feet off the ground. Okay, so there's dogs out there, and the dogs aren't making any sound, which is unusual. And I ran to the other room, called some of the other family members. They smelled the odor, ran back in. Of course, whatever was in the window was gone. Well, the guy had a health condition, was taken to the hospital, and he didn't get out of the hospital, I guess, until about a week later when I received the call from another relative about what happened. So I made arrangements on that day to go back to talk to him, which the event actually happened July 31st of 73. When I got out there and after I was done interviewing him, I found out that a number of young fellows had taken a shortcut to the local mall out there. A lot of brush and woods through there at the time. They had heard a commotion. They heard the sound, and they thought it was a deer. So they began throwing some rocks in. Instead of a deer coming out, here comes this very tall, hairy, man-like creature with very long arms, taking large strides, walking across the road and went up behind their home. And they all were pretty, I talked to several of the boys, they were all giving very similar stories, so I asked the family, you mind if I go up and look around on your property? So some of the kids followed me up, we walked around there for a while. Roy didn't see much of anything, about ready to leave when I happened to look down, and lo and behold, right in front of me is a very unusual, clearly defined three-toed footprint. It was 13 inches long and 8 inches wide.
Whoa.
And so I got on the radio, called another one of my associates, brought out casting material. We photographed, took measurements, made the cast. While we're out in the field, we get a radio report to another one of our investigators that morning. This is up in northern PA, north of Pittsburgh, almost the Ohio border. That morning, he had been investigating an incident where a large hairy creature looked in a window of a dwelling, and the police had found some large footprints in the area. Well, this is the beginning of this massive wave of Bigfoot cases that encompassed like a 7-county area of western Pennsylvania. And about the same time, down in the eastern part of the state, down around Lancaster, some Pennsylvania Dutch farmers reporting similar encounters on their farm as well. And I can tell you, these Bigfoot cases, you know, a lot of times when you hear about Bigfoot, somebody sees a large something far off in the distance, quite often at night. Well, many of these reports were very, very close range. When I say close range, I mean, in some cases, within 10 feet. A lot of cases in daylight, sometimes multiple creature reports, many times multiple eyewitness reports, and many times we had somebody on the scene, and there would be footprints, you know, there would be other evidence something had been there, and, you know, I say the best evidence that I've seen, and I can tell you police officers witnessed themselves in some of the cases, something could not have been fabricated, was how the animals reacted when they were close to these creatures. Now, people on different farms were responded to where these things were seen nearby, talked about how the horses and cattle were affected. They were scared. They weren't eating properly. But most amazing was how the dogs reacted. Normally, large, ferocious dogs. When these things were nearby, these dogs would not move. They wouldn't bark. They were shaking in fear. They were hide back in their pens. They'd go underneath housing around the area, trailers. They were just shaken, would not respond like any normal dog would respond. And sometimes people told us they wouldn't even eat properly for 2 or 3 days later. So you've got to understand now, these events went on for weeks and months until 1974 over a widespread area. We investigated dozens and dozens and dozens of these reports. It was unbelievable. But now, we went into this very open-mindedly, assuming from the reports we had that as other Bigfoot reports were reported around the country and around the world, and there was some history in Pennsylvania, we didn't have a lot of reports we knew of, but that we probably appear to be dealing with something with some type of unknown zoological animal, some type of unknown specimen. And that's what we went in looking at initially. Well, then, as time went on, we began to receive other reports, again, from the public, people not looking for any publicity, people many times calling the police because they were so frightened, and some very odd reports began to come to our attention. And I'll give you for example, okay, September 27th, I believe, up in Beaver County, there's two young ladies are out in the country area. They're waiting for a friend to pick them up. They see this large, hairy, white hairy creature, which is not that common. Most of the time you get reports of dark ones. This thing was white. But most amazingly, here's this hairy creature, very tall, very long arms, running across the road in front of them. But in its one hand, it's carrying a small sphere of light, a glowing sphere in its one hand. And as it's running into the woods, an object comes across the sky, which they thought at first was an airplane, but then this thing kind of hovers, and a beam of light is dropped down from the object into the woods in the area where this creature had ran into. So that one was very intriguing. We began to receive some other reports with some similarities. And then we had a very classic case, which has been written up all over the world, and Richard probably has this written up in his book. I don't know yet. But October 25th of 73, outside of Uniontown, PA, in Fayette County, multiple witnesses, about 15 people in a small little rural community, see this very large, about barn-sized red sphere of light dropping from the sky slowly towards this pasture area. So the farmer's son and two younger boys, they go up to the pasture. I'm just abbreviating this story right now.
Okay.
And he grabs his 30-06 rifle, grabs some ammunition, including a couple of tracer rounds, and they proceed up towards the pasture. They get up there, and this thing is on the ground. It now looks like a half of a hemisphere. It's bright white. It's illuminating the whole area. It's either right on the ground or right above it. It's making this high-pitched whining sound. And also, they notice as they're going up in the field these, like, baby crying sounds as well. So they get up to the field, and they're all amazed watching this thing. And they're not there very much of a time when they notice along this fence line about 75 feet away. Now, the fence post is about 6 feet tall. They notice these two tall figures slowly walking along the fence line in their direction. Well, at first they're looking at them and they're thinking they're bears. And then they realize that these things are bipedal. They're walking upright. One is probably about 8 to 8.5 feet tall. The other's around 7 feet tall. They come with long, dark, matted hair. They have glowing green eyes. There's a funny smell in the air like burning rubber. And these things are walking slowly, one behind the other, along the fence. So the one kid's yelling the guy, shoot him, shoot him. So he fires a tracer. It's just a flash of light. He fires a second tracer. And when he fires that second tracer, the largest of the two creatures reaches out to grab at that tracer. And when it does that, the object in the field just vanishes. It doesn't take off. It just disappears. The light's gone. The sound stops. It's dark. It's just a whole different scenario. What happened there? The creatures slowly turn around, start walking back towards the woods. Well, the one boy's already hysterical. He runs out of there. The other guy shoots right into him with regular ammo, and he says, "I know I hit him, but there was no indication that they were injured of any type. They kept moving back." Well, at that point, they both run out of there, get out of the field, run down to the farmhouse, tell the family what happened. They take him to a farmer's house, called the state police. State trooper comes out about 45 minutes later. I'm here to investigate the flying saucer. And the witness says, forget it, you're going to think I'm nuts. And the trooper said, look, we had a report of two similar creatures up on the hill or up on a mountain the night before. I have to investigate. So they jump into the patrol car. They got up into the field. And as the trooper told me, he went over to the area where the object had been, and the whole area was self-luminescent, glowing. He said about 100, 150 feet in diameter. He said when he went into it, it seemed to be a little bit warmer than on the outside perimeter. The animals wouldn't go anywhere near it. He shined his flashlight beam until he could barely see it. And the story goes on and on, but it was a very well-documented case. You may know Dr. Berthold Schwartz. He's a very famous psychiatrist, been in the paranormal field for many years.
Yeah.
Well, he lived in New Jersey at the time. He came up here and spent about a week, interviewed all the people involved, did a very intense investigation of it, wrote this up in some journals, and went away convinced that these people were all telling the truth. So here we have this unusual scenario. And again, as I tell everybody, and I bring this out quite commonly, very few Bigfoot reports have a UFO associated with them. Very few UFO reports have a Bigfoot associated with them. But the point is, there are some very well-documented cases where this type of thing has happened. And if you've been involved in this field for a while, and you've talked to people in both fields, cryptozoology and UFOs, there are some people in the UFO field that don't like to hear about the Bigfoot connection and vice versa. My position as a researcher is to go out and investigate and find out what this is all about.
I am so glad to hear you say that, because it's funny that you mentioned how few cases there are that have both of these, because I'm watching the message board and somebody said, well, this is just like what happens here in Colorado, and all I could think was it sounded like the Skinwalker Ranch case in Utah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had the same thing. They had Bigfoot sightings and UFOs. And do you have any theories on why UFOs and Bigfoot appear together? I mean, why are people having these sightings?
We don't know. Well, again, all we can do is gather information. There's many, many unanswered questions. As I've stressed, what, if any, direct correlation or connection is between the two phenomena? We just really don't know. The point is, however, that there have been some very well-documented cases where these things seem to show up in the same area or sometimes have been seen together. And there's a lot more reports. I mean, it's a small percentage compared to separate UFO or Bigfoot events, but there's a lot more cases out there than people know about, because for many, many years, many researchers have written to me privately about cases they investigated, but they were afraid to publish it or talk about it because they were afraid of their peers would laugh at them or ridicule them. And, if you watch the Internet, you talk to people in the field, I think in the last few years, you're beginning to see much more open-mindedness about there may be something more to the Bigfoot phenomenon than we understand. You know, I myself, as always said for years, I mean, we've had hundreds of Bigfoot cases in Pennsylvania. And just look at all the reports from around the country, throughout the world, of similar type of things that have been seen. And yet, just like the skeptics say, if these things are real, why are there no bodies? Why has nobody hit one with a car? Why has nobody shot one? Even though I don't recommend doing it, but we've had a number of people shot at them, and nobody's brought one down. So I've got to ask that question myself. And then if you have time, I can tell you about an amazing case, which might give us a clue as to why we have no bodies.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that. It's interesting because, as you mentioned, one of the witnesses, said, I know I hit it. You know, I shot at it. I know,
yeah,
I had to have hit it, and it didn't seem to notice. And that was the first thing that made me think of the Skinwalker Ranch case, because there was a dog of some sort. There was a wolf, I think, that was really huge.
Right.
And
the family
shot at it, and he said, I had to have hit it. It was point-blank range.
Right. I have two books that hopefully we're working on to get out in the very near future. And the one book, Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook, is going to focus on these reports from 73 and 74. It's going to go into a lot of detail and talk about a lot of things that the public's never heard about in these cases. Even though I published a lot of these things over the years, there was a lot of events that never were made public and some very intriguing stuff. So people can go to my website and keep checking for availability, which is stangordon.info.
Okay, www.stangordon.info.
Correct. And they keep monitoring to that when those books are available. But
now, one other thing that strikes me is the similarity in the sound of these cases to the Mothman sightings in the 60s in West Virginia, which were not that far, really, from eastern Pennsylvania.
Right.
When you first described this being seen, you know, these glowing red eyes looking in somebody's window that was 8 feet up off the ground, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, they said the Mothman had these glowing red eyes, and how does a Bigfoot get up to 8 feet off the ground unless they're just that tall, which, you know, they may very well be.
Right, and we've had cases of some that appear to be even taller, and in some cases with larger and smaller ones seen at the same time. And not in all cases do you have glowing eyes. Mm-hmm. Not in all cases do you have this terrible stench that people have reported very commonly. Rotten eggs, rotten meat, sulfur, different smells that are commonly associated with a lot of Bigfoot reports, but not in all cases.
Mm-hmm. And they're really seen all over the world, aren't they? I mean, when people talk about looking for Bigfoot or wanting to investigate sightings, we usually think of the Pacific Northwest.
Yes.
But you probably, I mean, clearly don't, because you've been spending the last 50 years studying these things.
Oh, yeah, and there are many, many reports all along the East Coast as well. I mean, all the states along the East have reported Bigfoot sightings. Pennsylvania has a very long history, going back to the late 1800s up to the present. The earliest firsthand account that I have where I've interviewed people goes back to 1931. And sightings go up to as recent as the last few weeks. There has been a pretty good number of Bigfoot reports coming in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society has been very active with some of the reports. I was up with one of their groups investigating a really interesting case that just happened July 10th outside of Uniontown, PA, which, again, is in Fayette County. And I've mentioned Fayette County a few times because it is a real hot area for reports. And there's a mountainous range. It's called the Chestnut Ridge. And the Chestnut Ridge runs from Preston County, West Virginia, through Westmoreland, Fayette, and Indiana County in southwest PA. That mountain ridge is a continuous year-after-year hotbed for various anomalies. There's a long history of all kind of UFO sightings, Bigfoot, strange animals, black panthers, things that fall from the sky, underground sounds. There's all kind of weirdness along the Chestnut Ridge, especially up in some of those areas around Fayette and Westmoreland County. And this case that just happened July 10th, I mean, this was a daylight observation. This was 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and a woman's just driving down the roadway, and she's going about, I think about 35, 40 miles an hour, and catches out of her left eye what appears to be a figure, a person, walking right into her lane of movement, of her vehicle. So she swerves to the right to miss hitting this individual. While she's looking up and swerving, she looks up and realizes this is not a person, but this is a very large hair-covered creature. And she got a very, very good look at it. This thing, she estimated, was at least 6 foot tall or taller, and it was bipedal. It was covered with dark hair. There was a very detailed account. You get on my website, you can read the entire account of it. And the most outstanding feature, she said, was the fact that the eyes were just very, very prominent. They're at least twice the size of a human, circular in shape. The eyes were completely dark, possibly black in color, wide set, and very wild looking. There was no iris, no whites at all, which was really frightening to this person. It was very stocky and muscular, had very long arms hanging down past the knees. And as she had swerved over, she looked in her rearview mirror just in time to see this thing leap over the back of her trunk. And next thing she knew, she's trying to get her composure back, and she looks up, and she looks to her right, and this thing's about 75 feet away, running down a road in the opposite direction. But when we went up to interview her and talk to her and her husband, we were looking over the car, and I happened to notice right behind the driver's side on the back of the trunk in the corner this large, unusual scratched area. So I went over and looked at it, and the scratch marks were deep in the paint. And I asked them, I said, have you ever seen this? And they said, no, we've never seen any damage like that. And there was an area about 8.5 inches long and 2 inches wide, and it was very long vertical, and it was long vertical and horizontal, very thin scratch lines that were deep into the paint. And, I mean, it would have been right in that position where the thing may have, you know, may have used that as it elevated itself over the trunk, but we cannot say for sure it's connected, but it was very interesting. So this woman, I can tell, was very upset, couldn't believe what she saw, was very reluctant even to tell her family about it initially. And since that time, there have been a number of other reports, even in the last week or so, up in that part of Fayette County that the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society is looking into.
Wow, that is just phenomenal. I'm sitting here just stunned, trying to think how I would react to something like that happening. I mean, I bet she had to sit there and regain her composure. I'd probably still be sitting there regaining my composure,
right.
Something like that.
Right, but if you'd like me to tell you about this other event, which, like I said, I believe it was a very interesting case, very detailed, very well documented, and that may be one of the clues as to why we've never got a Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to hear it.
Okay, well, I can tell you, this happened February 6th of 1974. This, again, of all places, up in Fayette County, way out in the country, up in the mountain, not too far from Ohio Pyle, and... For those people that were living back in 1974, they'll recall that it was a big nationwide trucker strike, and there was some violence on the highway at the time, there was gas rationing going on, and the state police in Pennsylvania were also being, the state police were being assisted by the National Guard at the time. So there were some events that, when the state police went out, there were National Guardsmen that also went with them as well. Well, this was one of these events that both the state police and the National Guard responded to this night. And what happened was, and we couldn't get up until the next morning because we couldn't get any gas. We got up early the next morning, talked to the people involved. The main person was a woman, lived out in the country all her life, knew animals, pretty much not afraid of anything, had a nice little house out there, way, way out deep in the woods. she had heard a commotion that night, like on her front porch. She had some tin cans and some garbage over in the corner, and there had been a pack of wild dogs had been coming through there. So when she heard this noise, she figured the dogs were back. So she grabs her shotgun and prepares and loads the gun. It's going to fire over their head to scare the dogs away. So she goes over to the front door, open up the front doors of the front porch, turns on the light, steps out, walks onto the porch, and lo and behold, there's no dogs there, but only a few feet away, here's this huge, hairy creature, about 7.5 to 8 foot tall, long arms, with arms raised up over its head. What does she do? She fires right into this creature with a shotgun. I said, well, what happened? She said, there was a bright flash of light, like somebody took a picture with a camera, like a strobe went off, and the creature disappeared right in front of her. Now, that's not the end of the story. So, about 100 feet away, her daughter and her family lived. They heard the gun. They heard the shot. They called on the phone and asked what happened. She explained it to them. The son-in-law grabs his pistol, makes his way up towards her home, and he told me there was shadow of 4 or 5 hairy people with glowing red eyes, like coals of fire, surrounded him. And he began to shoot wildly at them and ran into the house. When they looked out the window, here's this large object they described like a big Christmas ornament with glowing lights hovering over the trees at the same time. Now, this is one of those cases where they called the state police. They were pretty frightened. By the time the trooper got up there and some of the National Guardsmen, of course, whatever was there was gone. But this is one of those cases where the troopers verified and said they were just amazed at the animal reactions. How they put their arms in some of the cages where these big, like I believe one was a German, there was an Eskimo Spitz, I think a German Shepherd, some big dogs that should have been going crazy, barking, going nuts, should have ripped that trooper's arm off, and that dog wouldn't move. He said, I physically tried to pull that dog out, and the dog wouldn't move. He said, it didn't bite me, it just did not move, it was like it was paralyzed. And he said, to see that was so intriguing and amazing. And there's no way the animals could fabricate this. People can be fooled, but animals cannot. And that's one of the best evidence I've seen over the years that we're dealing with something unusual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to wonder, when people talk about hallucinations and mass hysteria, group hallucinations, all of this, I mean, would dogs share in that? I wouldn't think so.
Well, I can't tell you about that, but
yeah.
It's just these are typical of some of these type of events.
Yeah.
This is something that's been reported in many of these very close, even some UFO cases, but mainly with Bigfoot cases, where these things are very close to these animals, and the animals, even inside the house, people talked about how the cats were hiding underneath the bed, which they don't normally do. The young babies were crying unusual during the time, and they rarely ever did. So it was animals, both inside and outside, and in the field, they were all responding similar when these events were going on.
Wow. I just got chills from that.
Wait till you read the book.
When is your book coming out?
Well, we're working on publication on that right now, so we're hoping over the next several months to have these books out.
Holy cow, that sounds just...
Yeah, the other book is going to be called...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, God, I'm sorry. The other book is called Really Mysterious Pennsylvania, and it's going to go into a number of very interesting cases involving, again, UFOs, Bigfoot, other mysterious events, most of which I was involved in investigating. And there's some truly very detailed, very close-up UFO cases, not something you've seen a half a mile away, a light in the sky, but cases where these things were, you know, 40 feet above vehicles, one fellow who basically just stood right underneath an object, it was close enough, he could have touched it. I mean, just very, very detailed accounts of cases that you just cannot easily dismiss.
So is that part of the series? I've seen, like, Weird New York and Weird New Jersey and...
No, this is my own.
It's separate. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow, it sounds fascinating. I can't wait to see it. And so for updates on the book, we should be checking your website?
Yeah. I'm sure it'll get out there, but I'll let you know when it's available, too. But you can check my website, stangordon.info, for information.
Great. So, Stan, what will you be talking about in Pittsburgh next week?
Well, we're going to be talking about, again, the series of events that happened in 1973 and 74, and also talk about some of the more current, more recent reports of UFO, Bigfoot cases, other phenomena that have happened in the last several years. And even some cases that happened this year, been quite a lot of reports, been, you know, some very interesting UFO cases that happened this year. These sightings go on all the time, and not just in Pennsylvania, but I'm sure throughout the country and around the world. And, you know, I can tell you in Pennsylvania alone, probably 95% or more of the events that are reported, the public never hears about. Because, mm-hmm. one, most people today still, a lot of people still don't want any publicity. And UFOs are beginning to get a lot more positive attention. People are much more willing to talk about it. Bigfoot cases, many people are still very reluctant to report seeing something big and unusual like that. But people do report it. But a lot of people don't want any publicity. So that's one reason why lots of times it doesn't reach the news media. And a lot of people come to myself or other researchers, and they ask to remain anonymous. So, you know, that's a part of it, too.
Right. It limits how much you can actually do.
Right.
Do you work on other cryptozoology cases other than just Bigfoot?
Oh, yeah. I've been involved in this, again, since I was very young. And I get calls on all kind of phenomena. I worked on Black Panther sightings, the Eastern Cougar, a Thunderbird reports of the giant birds.
I was just going to ask about the big cats. You know, someone just sent me an article about that just recently.
Uh-huh. And then there are always reports coming in of mountain lions. Of course, mountain lions, we know they definitely exist, but they've been declared in the eastern part of the country since the late 1890s, where officially they've been declared extinct. But there have been hundreds of reports ever since that time. I mean, over the years, I've had reports of people seeing more than one adult cat together, very close range in daylight, where there's no way they could misidentify what they saw. There have been other reports, allegedly, of adults and cubs being seen. I did make a very good cast of a paw print where the police had called my research group out in the 1980s up in Armstrong County, where there had been a number of mountain lion sightings. We got a very good paw print, and there's no doubt that it was a mountain lion case, because there are certain ways you can identify a mountain lion track from a dog track and other type of animals. And the Black Panther reports are much more interesting, because nothing like that has ever existed in this part of the country, but people report them. And, in fact, there'll be some really interesting reports on that in one of my upcoming books. And so there's just a lot of mysteries out there that we just, you know, a lot of things you can explain, but there's some things you just cannot.
Yeah. Do you find any connections between UFOs or Bigfoot and some of these other crypto cases, like the large cats? Because we were talking about how we're starting to get reports of Bigfoot and UFOs being seen in conjunction with each other. Is it only Bigfoot or the other animals as well?
I can tell you historically from talking to other researchers, and I can tell you there are some. We have had cases where sometimes we might have a localized series of events going on, sometimes for days or weeks in a certain area, not talking about the 73 other years. And in some of those events, we would have Black Panther sightings showing up in that same area by other people reporting that type of event as well. And I know if you read some of the old books going back to the 70s, the 80s on these cases, you'll sometimes find that, and just like talking about the Skinwalker case, that they had other mysterious animals show up with strange lights, with orbs, all kind of things like that. So I think this phenomena is much more complicated than a lot of people realize. I don't think there's one easy explanation for the unknown category of UFOs, personally. And I've investigated thousands of cases, I can tell you. I've talked to thousands and thousands of people. I've interviewed all kind of people, from kids to people from all walks of life to military and commercial pilots, air traffic controllers, state troopers, very credible people who most wish no publicity whatsoever, but they're mystified about what they observed or encountered themselves, and they want to have some answers for it. And unfortunately, we still really don't have all the answers.
Yeah. I mean, you especially can say that. You've been in this field for 50 years, and you probably are still finding that the more you learn, the more questions you have.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there were times over the years where you gathered all this data, you began to see patterns emerge, and then all of a sudden something else showed up that completely took you off that theory. And sometimes I think the more we know, the less we know, the more confusing the whole phenomenon is.
Does that give you the impression almost that there's someone directing this, as if there's some sort of outside intelligence, as John Keel postulated in some of his books?
Oh, yeah.
He said the more you look into this and you start to find a pattern, as you were just saying, and then all of a sudden it's as if someone said, no, it looks like there's a pattern, but really this is going to disprove everything. Something would happen that would just shatter it.
Yeah, that was something we found many years ago.
So,
like I said, I think there's a lot more to this than we understand. I don't think there's one easy explanation for the unknown category. I think it's much more complicated. You know, a lot of this stuff, well, years ago, again, even when you talk to your peers about some of this stuff, you'd got a lot of ridicule. And back in the early days when John Keel's books were coming out, and then some of the investigation I was doing in the early 70s began to verify and confirm some of the things John had talked about and other people who weren't well-known at the time. And I began to look a lot into the backgrounds of people, too, who had some of these cases, and you began to find, and not all cases, and unfortunately, really didn't have the time or capability to really do statistics, but, you know, sometimes it seemed as though there were certain individuals who, when you went back and you interviewed them, found out about their histories, that some of these people had a history of very type of paranormal experiences from the time they were very young. And some of these people, over a period of years and throughout their lives, began to have many different types of encounters with all kind of phenomena, from alleged hauntings to UFOs, sometimes Bigfoot, other strange events. And it makes you wonder, you know, are there certain people that have certain abilities or are more sensitive to certain abilities? Are they able to perceive beyond the normal audiovisual ranges of other humans, that they're able to perceive this phenomena differently, or that the phenomena might be attracted to them? And then we had some cases years ago, for example, where you had a group, a small group of people looking at up in the sky, and a couple of the people in that group are talking about seeing this object, and the other people couldn't see it. So you've got some interesting things that makes you wonder.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because everyone's standing there together, they're all looking at the same spot, but some people see it and some don't.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a really interesting point, too, because in UFO research, people talk about experiencers and abductees, that it seems to follow a family line. You know, people are noticing now, and a lot of people who are new to the literature are not aware of this, but that if you talk to someone who's an abductee, if you look back in their family history, it's very likely that their parents were, too, and maybe their parents were, and can keep tracing it back.
Yeah.
Another thing I've heard mentioned is that there are certain racial types that seem to pop up more in the reports of abductees, and these tend to be Native American and also Celtic. And those two groups also, in other literature and other fields of research, seem to be linked with heightened psychic ability. And I've always thought with the Native Americans, maybe it had to do with a certain attitude, a certain philosophy, you know, growing up with a more spiritual attitude and being in touch with nature. But, you know, there's this tradition in Celtic families and bloodlines of having second sight, which is psychic ability.
Yeah.
So I've always thought, wow, isn't it interesting that those are the two groups that some researchers say appear most. They're the most likely to see aliens,
mm-hmm.
and they're also the most likely to see ghosts. So what is it about them?
Mm-hmm. And there's also, and again, I'm not saying specifically, but over the years, we've had certain areas of Pennsylvania where there was a history of petroglyphs, of alleged Indian burial grounds, a history of that type of thing in certain areas where you seem to have quite a bit of activity going on at certain times as well.
In Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Where are there petroglyphs in Pennsylvania? I was just
thinking
about...
Up in Fayette County.
In where?
Up around Perryopolis. Remember I was talking about Fayette County earlier?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, up in Fayette County, there's some petroglyphs I can think right off the top of my head.
I was just earlier today researching petroglyphs and thinking, I want to go see some, you know, and I'm thinking I've got to go out west. I didn't even know there were.
In West Virginia, I believe there's some interesting things down there in that area.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to tell Rich that there are going to be a couple weekends when I'm not going to be home.
Well, tell Rich if he comes down this way to stop by and we'll have a little chat. You're welcome. Of course, we'll all get together and talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's down there in Philadelphia now.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's speaking at a conference this weekend, and you'll be speaking at the conference next weekend.
Right.
In Pittsburgh.
Correct. Actually, the event is in Youngwood, Pennsylvania, which is about 45 miles, maybe southeast of Pittsburgh. It's only several miles outside of Greensburg, PA, which is my hometown. So the event is actually in Youngwood, PA, at the Westmoreland County Community College. In Youngwood. It's on my website. There's information there, and also you can go to the PennsylvaniaMUFON.com website as well for information.
And that website is www.pamufon.com.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It should be an interesting event. I know a lot of the speakers that are coming, so they're going to hear some very so there'll be talks on UFOs, Bigfoot, paranormal, hauntings, a lot of things like that, and should be a pretty interesting day.
I was really fascinated to see that there's a MUFON conference, which you would think is all UFOs, that's actually embracing things like Bigfoot and paranormal investigation. That's really nice to see, because as you and I were just saying this evening, there are a lot of UFO researchers who really don't want to have anything to do with, you know, muddying the waters with Bigfoot mm-hmm. stories and, you know, looking into ghosts and poltergeists and things.
Well, once again, you know, anybody that's really seriously out there interviewing people, properly investigating, asking the right questions but not leading the witness, when you begin to talk to these people and you gather information on their backgrounds or family history, you can't dismiss the fact that these things come up. You don't go looking for it, but from years and years ago, people start telling you about other strange experiences they had in their lives or other people in the family had. And when over years and years and years, you start talking to so many people and you begin to see similarities, you can't laugh this off.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, Stan, thank you so much for joining me. Unfortunately, we've blown through an entire hour. That was just way too much fun. I would love to come down and hear your presentation next week.
Sure, hopefully you will.
Yeah,
and people can keep checking my website for updates. This site I have right now is a little in early stage, but it'll be added more and more as time goes on. But there'll be updates on sightings and events and media events that I'm involved with as well. And also, if they want to get a copy of my award-winning documentary on the Kecksburg UFO incident, it's called Kecksburg, The Untold Story. It's never been seen on TV before, but I won the EBE award for it several number of years ago, and you can order it through my website as well.
Oh, fantastic.
The information is on there.
www.stangordon.info.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining me, Stan.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And thanks to everyone who joined us for the first hour of Through the Keyhole. This is Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. We're going to take a few minutes break, and when we return, we'll be talking with another presenter from the Pennsylvania MUFON Conference to be held next week, October 17th, in the Pittsburgh area. Her name is Patty Wilson. She's a paranormal investigator. So don't go too far. We will be right back. I'm Karen Dolan. Thanks for joining me. And you are listening to the second hour of Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest for the second hour this evening is author and paranormal investigator Patty Wilson. She lives in my neck of the woods, fairly close. She's in central Pennsylvania, and I'm in upstate New York. Seems like most of the people I interview are from out west. A lot of UFO researchers seem to be out that way. Patty's going to be presenting next week at the Pennsylvania MUFON Conference, which will be held in the Pittsburgh area. I believe it's actually in Youngwood, Pennsylvania. Patty, thanks so much for joining me on Through the Keyhole.
Well, thank you for having me.
I find it really interesting that a UFO research group, the Pennsylvania MUFON Group, has invited you to speak on paranormal investigation. I think that's really terrific. There's been a lot of I don't know how to put it, not exactly bad feeling, but it seems like there have been a lot of UFO researchers, for example, who don't want to look into any other topics, and maybe some paranormal investigators who don't want to have anything to do with UFOs. So I think it's really great that you're doing this.
Well, I have to admit, you're right. There's been a little bit of a standoffishness on both sides sometimes. I've been very fortunate because I have made friends in both the Bigfoot community and cryptozoology and the UFO research, as well as my own field, which is paranormal. And we have, in central Pennsylvania, we've actually been very fortunate in that we all get to come together. People who have an interest in one of these subjects, quite frankly, often have an interest in another, and there's really no reason to think that our subject is the only one that's of interest or the only one that's valid. And so this ability to share, which, you know, MUFON and John Ventry has offered to us, has been invaluable because it's a wonderful learning tool. I learn a lot. And as a matter of fact, next year I have a book coming out which is about Pennsylvania monsters, which is all cryptozoology.
Ooh.
And the following year there will be a book on UFOs in Pennsylvania. And neither of these books would have been possible without those communities of people being generous and opening their doors to me. And I have learned so much through this process that I think we all were benefiting from.
That is so cool to hear about your new books that are going to be coming out. Do you know specifically like what time of year they're going to be coming, or just, you know, sometime next year? I'm going to have to keep watching for these.
Well, I know Pennsylvania Monsters book is written. It's at my publisher, which is Stackpole Books, and I believe they have it slated for next summer. And the UFO book isn't written yet, so that's my project for this
more time
winter.
For that. That'll be a little longer.
Yeah, usually I do 1 to 2 books a year for Stackpole, and then I also have my own little publishing house. And because I'm a terribly prolific writer, I write probably 6 books, 7 books a year.
Wow.
So
that's fantastic.
It keeps me busy. It does. But yes, and I know that Stackpole's already committed though to the UFO book, and we've done all the preliminary work for it. All the research, background research, has been accomplished, and it would have been impossible without the wonderful researchers that I'm going to get to go speak and present before this on the 17th.
Fantastic. I looked at your bio in preparation for this interview, and I was really blown away by just the long list of books that you've written. You've got Haunted Pennsylvania, The Pennsylvania Ghost Guides, Volumes 1 and 2, Haunted Taverns, Inns, and Hotels of Pennsylvania. I see Haunted Pennsylvania with Mark Nesbitt. I spoke with him actually on Through the Keyhole about ghosts in Gettysburg.
Mark is a dear friend. We've been friends for almost 20 years now. And we have written together 2 books of Haunted Pennsylvania for Stackpole and also the Big Book of Pennsylvania Ghost Stories for Stackpole. And we have had a great deal of fun together, both writing books, researching them, and also we do paranormal investigating on occasion together as well.
That must be fascinating. What's it like doing a paranormal investigation? I mean, I've seen a couple of episodes of Ghost Hunters. I haven't really had a chance to sit down and talk with someone who actually does this. I have a sneaking suspicion that what we see on TV is very different from what it would be like actually being there.
I would say yes, and it's through no fault of anyone's that it is that way. You get to see, you know, this amalgam of weeks of work. They have to just part down to the littlest tiny pieces to continue the storyline. What happens usually for me is someone contacts me about their home or their business. They have a reason, a concern. Frankly, some people are just curious. They want to make sure that they're right, or they want validation of some sort. But quite often we have somebody who is concerned about what's occurring. They want to know that they're okay, that this is not going to be harmful to them or their families, or, you know, something along those lines. And that begins my process, and it becomes a winnowing process where we will go in and we will have sit-down conversations, them and I. And I have a partner whose name is Scott Crownover, who will casually be walking through the house doing baseline readings, but he's also observing the types of books they read, the movies that are on their shelf. All this kind of factors into the psychology, what kind of medications they're taking, if any, and I mean no disparity to anyone. You know, all of this becomes part of the process, and I'm talking to them and trying to figure out the psychology behind this person. Is this a person who's just seeking some sort of a thrill? Are they seriously frightened? Are they just confused by what's going on? There's a lot of different things you have to think about in this process.
So if you go into a home and you see a lot of books on paranormal topics,
mm-hmm.
on the shelves, what are you going to think about this case? Are you more inclined to think perhaps these people might be imagining things, or they might be playing a joke on you, or perhaps they are overreacting to something and they've gotten themselves all worked up and frightened over nothing?
If I had an inclination, it would be more that they were a little bit worked up over nothing. And that's usually the premise I go on. And again, I mean no disrespect to the person. It's merely that we've had that encounter before.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never had anyone play a joke on me, I have to tell you that. That's never even been an issue. I have had a few folks who wanted a haunted house that didn't have one. Because they thought it was cool. They were a little upset when I informed them that, to the best of my ability to tell, there was nothing in this house. But most of the time, there's something at play, whether it's some physical factor in the house that's causing a problem, or there really is some paranormal activity, and I have to determine what they want me to do, and if it's possible to do what the homeowner wants me to do. And it becomes a journey, sometimes a very emotional journey, sometimes not at all emotional. But on those cases where it is an emotional journey, my job is to figure out what's best for not only the human being living in the house, but possibly also the spirit. Because the one factor that sometimes, most often actually, gets lost in the mix of telling these stories is that I'm not hunting ghosts. I'm hunting nothing. I'm hunting people. These are human beings who have lost the physical shell, but they still have thoughts and feelings and desires, and they still need to be treated with dignity and respect. And that is so often lost in all of this. But that is also a part of what I have to do. I have to consider, how do I handle this? What's the personality of the spirit, and how are they going to respond and react? And also, you know, is it possible to do what the human being wants me to do and what the spirit needs to have done?
I don't think I've ever heard anyone mention that before, that when they talk with these spirits or interact with the spirits, that they're people, that you think of them as people and you treat them as people.
They are people. I have repeatedly had this brought home to me as an investigator throughout the years. The second ghost guide has a picture of Scott on the cover and this spirit energy shooting out of a grave.
Oh, wow.
And it was a really good picture. It's this gold energy just coming up out of this grave. And it was taken on an investigation, actually one where it was a fairly dramatic story. And I told the story at a local library years ago. And when the story was over and the whole lecture was finished, this man was standing there, and he came up to me, and he had tears in his eyes, and he's holding a copy of this book. He said to me, "The story, I need to ask you about the cemetery." And I answered his questions, you know, very patiently, where the cemetery was, where in the cemetery this photograph was taken, and et cetera. And he started to cry. And I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "That's right by my brother's grave. My brother's buried in that cemetery." And I said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry. If I'd have known that you were here and that this was the connection, I would never have told the story." And he started, he was just openly weeping by now. And he's like, "No, you don't understand. I really believed that when my brother died, there was nothing of my brother left. And you're standing here tonight telling me he still survives. And I really never knew that until today."
Oh, wow.
Every time I'm tempted to be human and to forget that these are people, I remember his face. I remember a woman walking up to me and saying, "The story you told was of my grandfather. Wow, you had him pegged. He's exactly that way." I'm not telling ghost stories. I'm telling people stories.
Mm-hmm.
I write about human beings who have descendants, who care about them, who love them, who want them to be respected. I told a story years ago in, I believe, the second ghost guide again, of a woman who was murdered by her husband, and he only confessed it on his deathbed. Her son from her first marriage, who's now an old man living in California of all places, received a copy of the book, and I did the story with the family's permission. I would like to stress that. And he wrote me this lovely letter. Thank you for telling everybody that my mom didn't commit suicide, that she didn't leave us willingly. I've lived with this my whole life. I'll never forget. They're not ghost stories to me. They're people's family stories.
Wow. That's so easy for us to forget, for people like me. You know, I read ghost stories. I grew up reading ghost stories. And they're are all things that happened hundreds of years ago, and there were all these drafty old castles in England, and, you know, you forget because it's just, it's so distant. It's so physically distant, and it's so distant in time, and they're just not real people. It's a ghost, and they don't have personalities in these stories. And it's so refreshing to talk to you because you've actually interacted with these spirits, and you know that they are people and that they still have the personalities that they had.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. You know, people will say, I see ghost stories on TV all the time where they're very evil and they're very nasty. And there's a strange thing in Hollywood where they can't seem to determine the difference between a demonic and a ghost. Mm-hmm. And so you see a lot of nasty stuff. In real life, you don't meet a lot of nasty ghosts, just like you don't meet a lot of truly nasty people. Most of us never meet a truly evil human being, and we're better for it. And it's the same with hauntings. I'll meet, you know, grumpy old curmudgeons, and I'll meet nice little old ladies that want to offer you tea, and, you know, different kinds of spirits, kids that are just playing pranks, and people who are confused or lost or hurt or disoriented. And you have to have compassion on all of those things. You said about knowing Mark. Mark has a house he calls the ghost house in Gettysburg, which is where their offices are. The second floor of the house has one of the most dear spirits in it that I've ever encountered, and her name is Mrs. Kitzmiller. She owned the house longer than anybody prior to Mark, and she's quirky and funny and spunky, and I absolutely adore her. There's, you know, EVPs, like there's one that he has where he asked her if she missed her husband after he passed away because she lived longer than him by several years, and she goes, no. You know, just, you know, funny things like that. Or one night Mark was saying, you know, that this is my house now, Mrs. Kitzmiller, and he's doing an EVP session, and I'm laughing because he's saying it's her house, and she's telling me, no, it's her house. It is her house. In her mind, it is never going to ever stop being her house. And she doesn't seem to be there for any horrible reason. It's not tragic or what have you. This is her home. She's there.
Wow. She sounds pretty amazing.
She's a lovely spirit.
What kind of things does she do? How did you first know that she was there?
Well, I never like to say the word sensitive, but I'm a little sensitive, and I leave it at that because I'm a mom. I've got three sons and a grandson. I'm not the crazy lady in a caftan, and I don't rely upon it as the only criteria for telling a story.
Uh-huh.
My stories are backed up by historical documentation. But, you know, that's how I knew originally, and they had already known she was there. She moves objects, and she kind of butts into conversations when you're recording and stuff like that. But she's also a very kind and compassionate lady.
Wow, she sounds like she's really something.
I love my visits with Mrs. K. A couple summers ago, I was there, and I had gotten some bad news, and I was crying. You know, just it was bad news, and I was crying about it. And I was sitting in the apartment, and this tape recorder kept falling on the floor. So Scott said to me, you should turn it on and see what she wants, if maybe it's Mrs. K. And I had never tried to do EVP myself with her before, and so I did, and I only left it on less than a minute. I'm like, you know, if you have something to say to me, I'm right here, and I'm more than willing to listen. And I just waited a minute and turned it off, and he played it back, and you hear very clearly, very slowly, don't cry.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. And it was, you could really clearly hear that? Because I've heard some EVPs that sound to me like some of the investigators are sort of reading into it, but I've heard a couple that do sound very clear.
Yeah, this was a very clear, almost as clear as I just said it to you, on the recorder. And a lot of that has to do with the type of recorder they use. And, you know, I know that a DR-60 gives you tons of EVP, but it's not high quality. But you do get a lot, which gives you some feedback that, yes, there is something here, and I'm working with, you know, with this person and getting some response. But some of the newer Panasonics and what have you are really, and the Olympuses are really giving some clear, clear EVP.
Now, that raises an interesting point. As an investigator, you must come across a lot of amateur investigators. I'm sure there are tons of people who watch UFO hunters or they watch ghost hunters on TV and they're like, oh, okay, we're going to go investigate a haunted house. Do you see any problems with that, with people doing that sort of thing?
Yes. No, I want to caveat that answer, and I'll give you a big, some examples in a minute. But I do understand the curiosity, and everybody started out the same way. The problem is that today people just seem to think that that's all there is. Yeah, you go to somebody's house, you ask a few questions, you get an EVP, a couple balls of light called orbs, and you go, yep, it's haunted. Good luck. Goodbye. Have fun. I think the problems come in when people don't understand and respect the fact that these are human beings, that they are capable of moving matters, so they're therefore capable of harming, you know, although they don't often do that, they are capable of harming you. They are capable of attaching to you and going home with you and actually supplanting your own personality in rare occasions. So there's a lot of things you need to know. It's really rather like making a bomb from a do-it-yourself kit and hoping it doesn't blow up in your kitchen. And so all of this stuff is never talked about. It's never publicized. It's never, you know, communicated to anyone. And people find themselves in over their heads. What do you do if you walk into a haunted house and it turns out not to be a haunted house? It's, you know, a person who has split personality. That's happened to me. What happens to you if you walk into a house and it's actually a demonic and this person's, you know, flipping personalities faster than you can keep up with? What happens if you go to a situation and the person truly is, you know, somehow psyched out? These are all issues that need to be brought in into your mind before you walk out your own front door. What happens if you're in a cemetery at 3 o'clock in the morning and the cops come and arrest you because despite the fact that the nice lady down the street said nobody bothers you, it's trespassing?
Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem with the TV shows. I understand that they are entertaining. They are wildly popular. They are a bit educational. They do give people some idea of what an investigation is like. But the truth is they're so limited in time. In an hour show, you get, what, 42 or 44 minutes out time for the commercials. And they do try to pack an entire investigation into that time because it's nice for the viewer to get some closure. Because people don't really want to come back week after week after week and see if anything showed up this week.
And, you know, that's one of the problems is that you cannot neatly wrap up a paranormal investigation in an hour. You
right.
can't wrap it up in a day. A lot of my investigations are months, some of them years long. And, you know, there's a place we've gone to that we went to for 7 years. I have one of the best EVPs that I think anyone's ever had, but it took me 15 years to get it. This is not a job for somebody who's, you know, got ADD. You've got to be really patient. And stick to it, time after time, day after day. A haunting does not occur on a time schedule. So you really have to have the luck of the draw, right place, right time, you know, and everything's in the right order. It's very difficult.
Your equipment has to happen to be ready and happen to be working, because sometimes that doesn't, I mean, sometimes that happens too. I remember Mark Nesbitt talking about a certain place in Gettysburg where cameras don't work. And he was trying to tell
cameramen. Yeah, that's a possibility too, yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have a lot of things to learn before you get to that point. And I think that young investigators really want to get gung-ho and they want to take the pictures and they're not asking some of the hard questions. And then you get what I call the pseudoscientists, which are the folks who, I'm all techie. Everything has to go through the equipment.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the ghost doesn't know that. So, you know, it may not all go through your equipment. And you're missing pieces of the puzzle.
It concerns me when I see people following along with these TV shows, and I keep saying ghost hunters. I don't mean to be falling back on that one or singling that out. It's just that I don't watch TV very much, and that's the one that comes to mind.
Sure.
But I know there are lots and lots of these shows. I don't want to be saying anything that's going to offend somebody who's on Ghost Hunters and have them come back to me.
No.
I'm sorry, guys. I just mean this type of TV show, I can just see someone watching it and saying, oh, wow, this is fascinating. I'm going to go do this. And they go and get on the Internet, and they start ordering night vision goggles and tape recorders so that they can get EVPs and their electromagnetic field recorders. And they're like, okay, now I got all my stuff. I'm going to go to a cemetery or I'm going to go to a haunted house and walk through. And it strikes me that They may or may not know how to use the equipment. They may or may not know how to interpret any results they do get. And they probably don't have much idea about how to mentally prepare themselves and protect themselves when you're going into this sort of thing.
That's true. And they don't have the preparation that we have to go through with research. Before I do a house, I have learned every owner's name for that house. I've done everything in my power to garner whatever history there is available to that house, because that has to factor into your investigation. I always use this example because it's so clear. Suppose I tell you there's a monastery in Johnstown that's haunted by a lady in a purple dress. When I look into the history of the property, I find that it was woods, then it was a field, and then it became the monastery. So where did the lady in the purple dress come from? Mm-hmm. But then as I'm doing my research, I find out that in 1894, a wagon had an accident there in front of this particular monastery. The horse took off and the woman was thrown and badly injured. They took her into the monastery and were rendering aid while waiting for the physician to come, and she died in the front hall while the monks were trying to tend to her. Now I have a context for my ghost.
Right.
And this is not something that's easy to do. You spend 8 to 10 hours off-site doing research for every hour you're on-site.
And then, it's like we were talking about, if this is appearing on a TV show, for every hour that's on-site, that might be a minute or two
mm-hmm.
that appears on the show. And people really don't realize that either. People don't see, and therefore, it's not that they're not aware of all of the background work that goes into this. I think if you make them stop and think about it, they'd say, well, yeah, of course, we know it takes more than an hour. And yes, of course, you have to go research the property and the history of it. But you really have to work to bring that to your attention when you're doing this sort of thing. I think an awful lot of people just think, oh, wow, that looks pretty amazing. I can go in with a tape recorder and I can get an EVP.
Yeah, and you have to consider, what are you going to do if mm-hmm. a ghost reaches out and touches you? What response are you going to have?
I'd be saying things I can't say on the radio.
You know what? In the beginning you do, and after a while, honestly, you get a little more blasé about it. You're like, okay, that's no big deal. For me, it took a long time to find out what, sensitive meant, because I always assumed everybody saw the stuff I saw. I had no other context for it. So, it's kind of funny. I have my son sensitive, and the one night I heard my boys say, Mom, don't trip over the flashlight in the hall. And I said, why? And they said, well, it was turning itself on and off in here, so we just took the batteries out and threw it in the hall. Whereas somebody else might really freak out about it. And I kind of laughed. I thought, there's people that would think that was a hugely amazing experience. And my kids were like, will you turn the light off and let us sleep already? That was all their thoughts were, because we've lived in this house for a long, long time. It is haunted. It just happens that it is haunted. It's a 230-year-old house, and it was the original house in our village. And, their context for it was completely different, whereas a novice would have been extremely excited at that event.
I remember watching an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, I think it was, where they were talking about a haunted house. And I don't recall where the house was, but the woman who lived in it was just very down to earth about this whole thing. She said she was up late one night in her office just paying the bills or something, and she noticed her checkbook lifted up off the top of a shelf across the room and floated very slowly around the room. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I would be having hysterics. I mean, that's really scary. And they were recreating it, so I'm watching this thing, and I thought, oh, my God, that would terrify me if I saw that. She looked up and she said, put it back. And it swooped around and it went right back on the shelf where it had been. She went back to paying her bills. And I thought, oh, my God, that's pretty amazing to have that sort of attitude. That's what it sounds like you're talking about, that probably you and your kids get that way after you get accustomed to it.
Well, yeah, and it is a matter of that. Now, you either come across people who are very blasé about it after a while and it becomes part of their life, and they enjoy it, or they've learned how to just live with it. You live with your ghost. Or, people who get very upset and want to try to have the control again, and they're very frustrated because they can't have it. And we've lived in this house for many years, and we're very used to it. And, when stuff disappears, it's like, all right, guys, if you have it, you've got to bring it back now. They're getting excited and upset. And immediately it just pops up right in the counter or the table, wherever we were looking for it and couldn't find it. And, you know, we're just like, that's okay, that's fine, just let it go. It's just life, and that's really how most people who live in a haunted house deal with it. Some people get very attached to their ghosts. I know of a family that have a little girl about 10 years old who died in the early 1900s, and she's been seen there by neighbors and them by them and by people for many, many years, and they buy her toys because she loves to play with dolls and stuff like that. So they buy her toys, and they have a box of toys that they'll come home and they'll find them scattered across the floor, and they have no pets, and they know the little girl was out playing today.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is really a different way of looking at everything. And, again, they see her as what she is. She's a little, you know, 10, 11-year-old girl, whatever, and she likes dolls. And how they discovered that is they inherited an antique doll collection, very, very priceless, and they began to come home and find them all over the house. So to keep the dolls in the collection safe, they bought her a doll. And one doll begat another, and now she has a toy box.
That's wonderful. That refers back to what you and I were talking about earlier, how you see the spirits not as miscellaneous, random ghosts, which most of us, without realizing, we do see them that way, but you see them as people, as the spirits of the people who used to be alive.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really find interesting is that people assume that because they're dead, they suddenly know everything. I've had people, you know, come to me and say, I want to talk to my grandma. You know, and they'll say things like, Grandma, should I get married? I'm like, honey, if your grandma were alive, would she know the answer to that?
Yeah.
No, but she's dead. And that makes her what? Einstein?
Yeah.
She has no better perspective on it now than before. If they knew everything, then they would already know they're dead. They need to go to the light. They need to fix this. But they get confused. They get stuck in their emotions. You know, they're quirky. There's a place I know of that's a Hallmark store, and every morning they would come in and find specific magazines, girly magazines, shoved behind the shelves, and they couldn't figure out why. Well, when they brought a sensitive in, she began to talk to them, and they did some history on the house. They found out the house was built by a minister, and apparently this minister was still there. He was taking care of the property like he promised his father he would do. And he made a comment through the sensitive that made no sense to her whatsoever, but made perfect sense to the owner, which was something along the lines of, they can stay, meaning the people that live there now, could stay, but he didn't want those magazines in his house. And as soon as she said the words, and she's puzzled, I don't know what magazines, she says, the owners start to laugh because they know exactly what they're talking about, the girly magazines that he keeps hiding on them every day.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know,
okay, so I have to ask, I was a little unclear on this. Was somebody, I mean, the magazines were already there. He wasn't, like,
you know, there's it's a Hallmark store, so they carry magazines and all kinds of stuff like that. And he would take the out of the racks, the girly magazines that were for sale, and shove them behind the racks at night. And they'd come in the morning, and the girly magazines would be missing. And he wanted them out of his house. He didn't want them out where women and people could see them.
That's sort of charming, actually.
Exactly. I mean, when you get to know these people, they're people.
Yeah.
They've got all the quirks and warts and everything the rest of us do.
Wow. So, Patty, tell us about some of your most interesting investigations. What stands out in your mind as one of the most interesting cases you've worked on?
Well, I'll go back to the story I told you about the man who told me his brother was in the cemetery. That's probably one of my more dramatic stories. A lady wrote me a letter and asked me if ghosts could hurt you. And technically, yes, the answer is yes, it can hurt. They could hurt you, despite the fact you'll hear a lot of people on TV say, ghosts can't hurt you. Of course they can. If they can steal your car keys and smash a cup, they can hurt you. And she wrote beyond this that her little boy, who was about 5 years old at the time, claimed that there was a ghost in their house whom he called the mean man, and that the mean man wanted to kill him. And then she tells me, she hadn't believed him at first, but one afternoon she had taken him upstairs and laid him down in his bed for a nap and hit his infant brother in his crib. She went out to hang up laundry, came back in and heard thumping. At first she thought he was upstairs jumping on the bed. So she starts up the stairs to, you know, to correct him and get him off the bed before he hurts himself. And then she realizes it's not thumping like a bed being jumped up and down on. It's more like the thud of something hitting a wall. She rounds the curve into the bedroom, and there's this little boy chopping away with a huge knife at the chimney area, and he's sobbing. And she runs over, grabs this knife away from him, and she's like, "What are you doing? You can't do this." And then she realizes he's crying, and he's like, "Mommy, that's where the meat man comes from, and he's going to kill me. He said he's going to kill me. I have to get in there first." He's absolutely terrified.
A five-year-old boy.
Now, my first thought is either A, there's something really radical going on in this house, or B, this lady's very dramatic, and or she's nuts. And I needed to figure out which, because on one hand, you know, a lot of people may not want the drama, but if by any chance this story was true, then I had no choice but to help, because there's a five-year-old child involved.
Yeah.
Who is at the very least very frightened. So we go to the house, we begin an investigation, which of course takes more than, like I said, several weeks, and we weren't there every day. We would go maybe one or two days a week. And you know, work on the case. The upshot of the whole story is what we came to learn is that this house originally was a grocery store and post office on the first floor, and the whole second floor was a private residence. The man who built the house wanted them to leave the second floor of the house, where the little boy's bedroom was his living room, wanted them to leave that alone because that was his house. He had not accepted the fact that other people had moved in. And the little boy could see him, so he was basically bullying the child, hoping it would get the parents to leave. We had EVPs that confirmed parts of this. We had floor plans and history to prove parts of this. Interestingly enough, he kept going through walls, which when we looked at the floor plans, we realized weren't walls in his time period, so they made perfect sense to him that those were doorways he could walk through. And all of this became very clear as we're working through the case. The solution in this instance, the man wasn't going to budge. He didn't want to leave. He didn't have to. And I looked at her one day, and I said, "You rent this house. Move. It's that simple. Just move."
Yeah. If you're renting, especially, it's so much easier just to rent someplace else.
Exactly. I mean, we could have played around with this for a little longer and tried to, you know, convince him to leave and what have you. But in this instance, it was a rented house. So the simple solution, the easy, fast one for this child was move.
Now, in a case like that where you're encouraging someone to move out and you know that there is an unhappy spirit still in this house, and it sounds like this man was not going to accept anyone moving into this place, do you feel obligated in that case to let the landlord know what's going on or other tenants? If that had been a building that maybe a house with two apartments, would you have felt obligated to tell the tenants of the other apartment?
Well, actually, this was a house. It was a duplex that had people in the other half. The lady who called me in attempted to talk to the other tenants, who had this really interesting and you'll see this quite frequently with people in haunted houses. There's a group of people who have this very interesting ostrich approach to haunted houses. It's like, yes, I heard the thumping, but it was not a ghost. It was a cat. You're going, it was the cat walking up and down the steps? Yes, it was the cat. But the cat wasn't in the house last night. I don't care, it was still the cat. And that was sort of their mentality. I'm not going to admit it because if I do, it may be real. Despite the fact that this guy was, you know, walking through their walls and scaring their two little girls anyway. And so she attempted to tell somebody. And I would tell you that I believe that it's been my experience that not everybody who rents that house is going to have that problem. As a matter of fact, I'd say most people wouldn't. In this instance, the child could see the ghost. And so he took advantage of that and became obnoxious, if you will, trying to force their hand. And we could have tried to deal with it in many other ways, but if she was looking for a quick fix in that instance, the easiest, quickest fix was move. and the child's out of the situation. He's never going to be frightened of that house again because he doesn't have to go there at night. He doesn't have to climb into that bed and wait for the guy to come out of the chimney wall.
And threaten to kill him.
And threaten to kill him, which is what he claimed. Yeah.
Wow. That's horrible.
It's a very dramatic story. And, you know, there was a cemetery behind this house, is which actually is why we went to the cemetery, just to see if there was any activity going on in that cemetery. But, you know, that's one of the dramatic stories. I've learned an awful lot about what I believe happens to us as human beings when we pass away, based upon the information I'm getting from ghosts and my observations, you know, a lifetime of being who I am and doing what I've done. And, you know, I've had some really interesting experiences that way. And I think I'm a little more blasé. I'm not afraid to die. I don't want to die, but I'm not afraid to because I kind of get what happens. We just simply move on to a different plane of learning, if you will. And who we are is not forgotten. Who we are and how we think and how we feel, that comes with us. And I'm actually kind of happy about that. I wouldn't want to think that everything that was our experience here just gets washed away.
Yeah, that's very reassuring. Like the man who you spoke with, who said, you know, that you let him know that his brother was still there. And
yeah.
I can see why it meant so much to him. It means a lot to all of us. We want to feel that there's something more than just what we see here.
And we should, and I truly know that for a fact. You know, I've had instances where that's brought home to me repeatedly from different cases I've worked on, where they'll ask you questions about, you know, for example, I was just at a place called Hillview in Newcastle, and I encountered an older woman. It was a nursing home in recent years, and she was a little bit, I think she had Alzheimer's or something. She was very slow. And her husband, who she was telling me she was there because her husband Joe was there. And he was standing behind her, and he's a ghost, they're both ghosts, and he's shaking his head no at me. And so I understood that, you know, there was a different story, and that Mary was, this woman's name was Mary, that Mary was just telling me what she understood in her mindset. Unbeknownst to me, elsewhere in the building, there was an interview session going on for a radio program that was going to be taped that night, and three of the former employees were there. They're telling this particular radio show host a story about a man and a woman who lived in a nursing home, and it was really quite interesting the way it fell together. Then they brought them over to talk to me, and my first question was, well, were there ever any couples that lived in the nursing home together? Because I'm trying to piece together who these people are. And in unison, the three women look at me and go, I describe, you know, the lady and what she looks like and the man and what he looks like. And there was an odd way he had of holding her arm. And he would always tell me, he said to me a couple times, I just sit with her and wait. She's a little confused. I just sit with her and wait. Meaning she never crossed over. And immediately they go, oh my God, that's Joe and Mary, that's Joe and Mary. And we went through the process of crossing this couple over, and I really was kind of worried in my own head that maybe she didn't understand and it didn't work. And I just kept thinking about it all evening quietly, and I didn't say a word to anyone. And we're going through the building later on in the evening, and these three ladies had been former employees, wandered away, and all of a sudden I heard this, oh my God, look at this type thing. And I walked into the room they were in, and they were grinning like Cheshire cats, and in their hand was an old Polaroid of Joe and Mary that had been on the floor that they had just spied, and they recognized who they were. The problem is that we had video cameras all over that building, and that picture wasn't there an hour earlier. So, you know, it was confirmation. That's a dramatic story in a different way. And I have the picture. I mean, they gave it to me, and I really wanted to keep it because it's a remembrance of these people. And And Joe's slow devotion, his loving devotion forever, he said to me, I just sit and wait with her.
Wow. So when you do one of these investigations, when you contact the spirits who are there, I'm beginning to get an idea that you don't always find it necessary to help these spirits cross over. So it's not quite like Ghost Whisper, where every week, again, they do, you know, a case is brought to this woman's attention, she does the research, she finds out who they are, and then she contacts the spirit and she helps them cross over.
Well, if they don't want to go, like Mrs. Kitzmiller down in Gettysburg,
uh-huh.
She's happy. She runs the place still, and we all answer to Mrs. Kitzmiller. And that's okay. I'm fine with that. I've told the ghosts in my home, if they want to cross over, I will be there for them, and all they have to do is let me know. And to date, they haven't asked for that. If somebody's hurt, if they're confused, if the only time I get pushy is if I know this is not a good thing. I was in a prison one time, an old abandoned prison in Cambria County with the owner's permission, and I encountered a spirit in that room, in the one room, the one cell, and I said to him, why are you here? And he said, it's better than hell. And I, from that moment on, I knew this guy had to go. And I pushed really hard to get that guy to go, and he did. But, you know, I try to be fair. I try to be listen to what they want and need,
uh-huh.
and treat them like I would want to be treated if I were in that position, with some dignity and respect. And so far it's worked okay for 25 years, so I guess we're just going to keep going that way.
Wow. Sorry, I'm having a little technical problem with my phones here, but I think I got it straightened out.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry about all the beeping.
That's okay.
Darn, I got so fascinated with what you were saying, and I had a question, and then the darn phone started beeping, and it put my question right out of my head. Because we were talking about how you don't always find it necessary to help someone cross over, but in the case of this 5-year-old boy who was being terrorized by this spirit, if they perhaps had owned that house and couldn't afford to move, I'm assuming you probably would have tried to do something about that, or
then it would have become more of a clash of wills, his will versus
yeah.
mine. And there are times when you have to dig in and get determined and say, look, you've got a choice here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened in the prison. You know, I'm not going away. I'm going to stay here. I'm going to keep nagging you, and you're going to go. And, you know, there's times when you have to do that. You dig your heels in because it's not good. And if I'd come across a spirit that was, I don't believe for a moment this guy was really going to hurt the child, but it was psychologically damaging for him. And as I said, the simplest, easiest solution would have been move for them, because this could also escalate. You know, that's one of the other things they don't talk about on these shows. You know, if you start bringing people in here and they're messing with your ghosts, they can get mad. They can feel threatened. And, you know, much like if somebody would come to your house and try to throw you out, you'll fight back. And so they'll fight back in whatever ways they have. It doesn't happen often, but it is a potential that it could happen. And if it does happen, it's only fair that you have warned the homeowner and allowed them to make that decision, that they're willing to take that opportunity, that chance, and that they're cognizant of the fact that there is that chance.
Have you ever come across any spirits that seem to be something other than deceased humans?
Yes. I have come across 4 or 5 demonic entities and had to deal with them over the course of time.
What do you do about that? Are you able to deal with them yourself, or do you call in help? Do you call in church officials? Or?
Well, actually, on low-level cases, I can deal with it myself. I am certainly not adverse to calling in church officials. It is, however, exceedingly difficult to find somebody in any church of any denomination who is willing to take this on and understand what the process is. I have had ministers say things to me like, it's not fair to ask us to take that chance because this could ruin our lives. You know, I don't want my secrets told. Things like that, because demonics will tend to do that. They'll actually spout out the secrets of this person, if they have any. And it is an altering, a life-altering event. Now, if a case warrants it, I will continue till I find somebody to help us with the resolution. I'm fortunate in that I know at least three different demonologists and exorcists who can step into a larger case and can give me advice along the way. And I am a student of those people when it comes to these cases, and I ask their opinions quite frequently and listen and take notes and go through that process. And to some extent, you know, I've done this long enough that I kind of get a gut feeling about it. But yes, there are these instances. They are rare. Of 25 years, like I said, about four. And they require a different set of skills and a great deal of faith to get you through those particular incidents.
Now, when you refer to faith, do you find that any particular religion seems to be, I don't even know how to word this, do you find that one church over another seems to be more helpful in dealing with these, with the demonic spirits?
No, actually, I have to do two things. I have to figure out the faith of the person who's the homeowner and the faith of the ghost, because there's psychology involved in this. If the ghost doesn't recognize the relics you're using or the items you're using, then he may not respond. It doesn't have anything to do with a denomination. It has to do with your gut-level faith in God. And I've seen people of all denominations who have been very good at this. A lot of the people I know who are exorcists, they will stress that it's not denominational. It is about being a believer. And it's, that, again, down to that core of faith. Simply having that faith. It has nothing to do with going to church on every Sunday, although, you know, that is something that a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that there would be a lot more going to church on Sunday if you have something like that in your house.
It actually does. I mean, there's actually Monday I'm going to go back to a house that has a problem. The house has five small children and a 13-year-old boy, and this was actually unleashed through the use of a Ouija board. And we've been dealing with it for almost a little over a year now. And my goal in this instance is to give this family peace, to allow them to just be a normal family again. Because when this stuff happens, you get the siege mentality. Everybody sleeps in the living room, or the parents are up all night exhausted because the children are just stressed. And peace is my goal. And I've actually been shocked in that they happen to be Catholic, and their priest told them, go back to the lady that helped you before, she seems to be doing okay. And that would be me. I was really surprised. I mean, he came and he blessed her home and he did everything he was supposed to do, but it just required more work.
It sounds like he sort of cut them loose, which is, I don't know. I
don't mean to speak ill of any denomination, mm-hmm. and I certainly am not, because this happens in everyone. But you will find there is a huge disconnect between churches and helping people in that situation. They don't want to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Fully one-fourth Christ's ministry on earth, his healings, were exorcisms, casting out of spirits. And yet it is, I've known families who've come to me and said, I've gone through 16 ministers.
Oh, my gosh.
17 ministers. I had a woman tell me who's had was having a very severe problem. My pastor gave me a bottle, was a priest, gave me a bottle of holy water, told me to take it home, and whenever this happens, think good thoughts and sprinkle some of this around, which is really easy to say. It's not so easy whenever this thing's pinning you down in bed at night.
No, I wouldn't think so.
And so there's this disconnect. And again, it's fear on their part. I've had people...
You know, I mean, they're the people who've gone through the training. They have studied with the church for years,
mm-hmm.
in order to become priests and ministers and pastors. And they're saying they don't want to deal with it. In effect, what they're saying is, this is too much for me, so here, just take this holy water and you do it.
Yeah, they, I've actually had them say to me, I wasn't trained for this. I didn't become a minister for this. Mm-hmm. And I can remember getting very angry at one particular minister and saying, then what the heck did you train for? You know, I don't remember crying, hey, sorry, it was I'm off on Sunday. So you know, if you have the problem, just you know, deal with it yourself.
Yeah.
And that's really what ends up putting a lot of people in that position that exorcists and demonologists and what have you, as a rule, tend to be very low-key people. And there's like a network, if you will, that you can tap into. Now, John Zaffis, who's very famous for his work as a demonologist.
Yeah, I know his name. I've never spoken with him. But.
He's a lovely man, and I number him among my friends. And he's probably the most outspoken and has done the most to educate people on the subject. And so he is more high profile than most. But he has told me over the years many times that most demonologists and exorcists that have any real knowledge base and are very good at what they do tend to be kind of quiet and circumspect because, you know, you don't really want to announce to the neighbors that, you know, on Saturday nights they're out at dinner and you're doing exorcisms.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff. So it becomes a very quiet networking system. And it really doesn't get to that point quite that often. I mean, those are very rare cases, and thank goodness they are. A lot of times it doesn't require that much. And sometimes you can get lucky, and one visit does it. I've had that happen in one particular instance in Maryland where the family had a problem. We went down. We spent the day. We worked with them. We confronted this thing, and their teenage daughter got well.
So it can sometimes work quickly.
Yes, it's not always months and months long, and this hadn't progressed that far, and the parents were very vigilant. The teenage girl,